Good morning, it's Danger Dan here in the talk shop out here in Texas. You can hear the cicadas buzzing. Today's show is with my good friend, Simo. Him and his wife, Dana, have a brand called Huckleberry, and they put me and my wife up while we were in California for the Born Free Motorcycle Show. And we sat down and caught up. You know, people had told me that Simo's been in and around the motorcycle scene for a minute, and we got to discuss it, and it was rad. I had no idea that, you know, him and Jesse fucking worked together and started West Coast Choppers a long time ago. And he was in and out over like a 10, 15 year period, and we discuss all that and more. And dude, what a fucking trip. If you have the chance and you're at an event and Huckleberry is set up, make sure you go by and say hello and get a bandana and, you know, listen to Simo rattle off one of the stories that didn't make it onto the podcast. This was a lot of fun, and I can't thank Dana and Simo enough for putting me and my wife up. It was amazing. Made that trip fucking, you know, perfect. So let's get into this podcast. All right, like all shows, this show, like all episodes of the podcast, this show is brought to you by MC Shop Tees, your T-shirt of the month club, the only way to support every local motorcycle shop. That's right. Each month we do a feature on a different shop from around this country, do a one-off shirt, and send it to your door. It's like Christmas every month. You get to pick the size, the style of shirt, and each month it's a surprise. And it's a fucking rad thing, and we get to feature a lot of rad shops. Last month's featured shop was Bad Choppers, which is Borba's After Dark. Daryl Borba is a fucking incredible metal fabricator. Built a badass bike for Born Free this year, and is doing some rad things in Magnolia, Texas. And super sick to fucking feature him this year. At Born Free Texas, MC Shop Tees and Danger Dan is putting together a fucking killer show for you. I'm going to be doing the art show again, prints, paints, and steel. But the steel part of this show is going to be six choppers I've invited guys to build. Daryl Borba, Nick Resty, Warren Heyer, Dwayne from Peculiar Parts, Jay Ryan and Easy Company. Let me say that again. Nick Resty from Nick's Choppers. Warren Heyer, he is one of the founders of the Mama Tried show. Daryl Borba from Bad Choppers in Magnolia, Texas. Jay Ryan from Gusher Cycles. Dwayne, another Haint from Birmingham and Peculiar Parts. And then Easy Company. Dude, it's going to be sick. They're all building bikes to be at Born Free Texas. And what's special about this event we're calling the Build-Off Trade-Off, is on Thursday before Born Free, all the builders are going to go on a ride. I'm going to take them on a sick-ass East Texas bar-hopping ride, where at each location, they will all switch bikes. And each person will get a chance to ride each other builder's bike as we cruise through East Texas and wind up back at the canyon. And then on Friday, we'll open the art show to the public, where the bikes will be on display with a bunch of rad works of arts on the walls. If you were there last year, you got a glimpse. And Jeff Milburn will be DJing again, which, if you didn't see this last time, it was incredible. Jeff Milburn, you might have heard on the podcast recently, and you will hear again on the next episode, was the stunt coordinator for the new movie, The Bike Riders, which is incredible. And you'll hear more about that later. But he'll be DJing the opening party. And Saturday night, we'll have another party. But Friday and Saturday, everybody at the event will get a chance to vote on their favorite chopper. One of these six choppers is going to go home with a fresh motor built by B&B, you know, from the people's choice. You know, the people's choice. I hate using the people's choice, the people's champ. I'm going to come up with something. But you guys are going to get to vote on your favorite bike, and they're going to get a fresh motor, which is sick. Thank you, B&B Cycles. On top of that, Cycle Electric has hooked all of these builders up with a charging system. Now, these bikes that they are building, they're all going to be nose cone shovel, rigid frame, ratchet top, titled motorcycles, right? You may ask, why did I make them all build bikes with this baseline? Well, that's because on Saturday, we're going to fucking roll dice, and every builder is going to go home with another builder's bike. That's right. So they're essentially all building a bike to put up as an ante for a dice game. Isn't that fucking wild? I know. You're going to get a chance to be right there at the dice game, at the Prince Paints and Steel Art exhibit, and it's fucking rad. Lowbrow Customs is supporting us as well, and, you know, is helping these builders out. What a fucking wild idea, huh? I know. I can't believe they all said yes. Over the next few weeks, I will be releasing podcasts with each one of these builders. And, man, it's going to be fucking fun. So make sure you are coming to Born Free, Texas. You know, that's the biggest next event that I'm going to... Oh, wait, no, there's some more events. Fuck, it's just July. We got the Homecoming in Milwaukee coming up later this month. Sturgis. Then we got the Virginia City Roundup in Virginia City, brought to you by Choppers Magazine. And then Party at the Pin, where I will be one of the featured guests and be bringing my chopper to put on display, as well as bringing the band, the Outbound Train. And then from there, we will be touring back to Texas on the choppers, playing a show every night. It'll be Boise, Idaho, Salt Lake City, Durango, Las Vegas, New Mexico, somewhere in the panhandle, either Lubbock or possibly Post. And then we will end in Dallas, Texas with a show at Brown Cycles. So pretty fucking stoked about that. And I hope that you guys can catch us on one of these shows. So, and then we'll be back in time for Born Free Texas in October. It's gonna happen sooner. It's gonna be here. It's already fucking getting close. Anyways, if you don't, where was I going with this? I just lost my train of thought. Motorcycle Sherpa's got some trips coming up in November. If you want to go to Nepal, you fucking should. Don't wait around. Like, these are an amazing experience. And who knows what is going to happen at the end of this year. So you might as well fucking go ride your motorcycle around the Himalayas on a sick-ass expedition. I do have a winner for last month's Patreon donations. I will be drawing that at the end of this show. Thank you, Lowbrow, for supporting the show. You've been a fucking amazing for a long time, and I'm stoked to have you a part of this amazing show. Speaking of shows, let's get into this podcast with Simo. Hello.
Hello.
There's a chance that nobody hears this. There's also a chance a lot of people hear this. Is there anything you want to make sure we don't talk about?
I don't give a fuck about anything.
Perfect, because I was recording anyways. I was going to capture whatever that thing might be.
Yeah, nothing.
All right, now state your full name, date of birth.
My full name is Andrew Arthur Simonson, also known as Simo. I was born on May 29th, 1963.
Simons, that's your last name?
That's a Viking name.
You are a fucking Viking, dude. You're good. I forgot to sound check you. You are a Viking, dude.
Yes, that's I'm a
Viking name. And you grew up right here in this neighborhood?
Yeah. This house we're at right now, I moved into when I was one. I don't remember moving in, but I remember doing a lot of other things.
Really?
Yeah.
This house right here, hold on, I got a fucking, we're coming in hot. All right, try it. Give me some more.
Yeah, so this is a... You know, I think the water here in Yorba Linda is really, there's something wrong with it, because all of my friends are just as fucked as I am. We did a lot of really bad things.
Right here in this house?
In this house, this town, yep.
You guys just fucking run the neighborhood on your bicycles?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, like that Joe kid on a Schwinn or whatever, that was us. I mean, on any Sunday, the dude riding the wheelie. I mean, that's typical. Schwinn, Stingrays with ape hangers, doing wheelies, going up jumps.
Did you skateboard out here?
Yeah. We had some skateboarding stuff. The Big O started out here. That was really started the whole punk rock skateboarding thing.
What's the Big O? Explain to me.
It was a skate park over in Orange down the street that had, like, you know, some pools and, you know, whoop-de-doos.
What year did they do a skate park in Orange?
That was probably in 1982, 83.
Okay.
It was after I was out of high school.
Yeah, yeah. You started skating before that, huh?
Yeah, I was skating when I was a little kid. We'd go to the drainage ditches and find ones with smooth transitions and see if we could do some stunts.
Yeah. Did you surf at all?
A little bit. I mean, my brother-in-law, he took me to Mexico and we did some surfing there and there by south of Ensenada. There were some sand dunes and waves. It was cool.
Yeah, there's a bunch of waves down there.
Yeah.
Actually, it's fucking... That last trip, we did fucking dirt all the way, pretty much from Ensenada down to Scorpion Bay, almost.
That would have been rough.
It was fucking crazy.
Those dirt roads aren't the smoothest dirt roads out there.
No, but some of them are great.
Yeah.
Some of them are fucking great, and then all of a sudden they're not.
Yeah.
You know? Well, that's cool. I mean, we're not far from Mexico right here.
No, it's easy. That's like if you want to go get some of the best tacos in the world, you can plan a day trip and get them.
Dude, you can get them in San Diego.
There's one place in Rosarito that's the best ever in my world.
Rosarito?
In Rosarito, there's a taco stand called Tacos El Yaqui.
Okay.
Oh, man. They take one of them lard-filled tortillas, and they make a quesadilla with Oaxaca cheese.
Oh, fucking
man. And then they take the beef, like a flap steak, and they marinate it. Then they cook it on mesquite. And then after it's charred from the mesquite cooking on an open fire... They throw it in au jus, like a beef-based liquid. Like a liquid, but it's a beef liquid, and then they soften it up in full beef-flavored liquid. When they chop it up, they put it on the quesadilla with a spoonful of beans, a spoonful of salsa, and a spoonful of guacamole. And I've had vegans turn fucking carnivorous down there. I've taken them down there. I'm like, I know you only eat fucking plant shit, but try this.
Say the name of the place again.
Tacos El Yaqui.
Is it right on the main strip? Is it on?
No, it's off the main strip. Like when you go through the arch at the south end of town to get to the Rosarito Beach Hotel, it's like on that street to get to the main street.
So towards the ocean from one.
Yeah. Yeah. You go through the arch on the exit, on the second exit, like towards the south end of town.
That's by what, Papa's and Beer?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's over by there.
You've been there before, right?
I went to jail from there before one time. We were in jail for 3 days.
No way.
I thought I was never going to get out.
No way, dude.
We went down there to get my car to get it upholstered, but to pass out flyers for some punk shows. And the guy said his dad was the mayor of Tijuana, Baja, I don't know what. So we thought we could get away with anything. And we were in Papa's and Beer, and my friends got in a fight, and I'd already been drinking too much, so I was passed out in the back of the truck, and they woke me up saying, this is fucked. And he punched a car, and they hit the side window, and it broke. He's all, fuck, this Mexican glass is cheap. So he started walking down the street, punching every car window.
Oh, my God.
The next thing you know, the cops surrounded us, and they took us all to jail. And then another friend of mine, who was with us, he got arrested. He just got venereal warts, burned off his pecker. So they strip searched him like 12 times to show the other cops coming in off duty to show this guy's...
The burn marks on his dick?
Yeah, to show the burn marks on his dick. Oh, I think that's why we had to stay there for so long, because...
They were bringing in people from everywhere to see his fucking dick?
Yeah.
I mean, that seems like a pretty... serious offense, breaking a bunch of fucking vandalizing.
Well, I had the money for the upholstery under my sock. They never made me take my socks off. They searched everything else, but I always kept my socks on. So after 3 days, they said, yeah, the damages were like $290 worth of windows. So I'm all, boom, here's the money, because I had it. And they're all, where the fuck did you get the money? I'm all, I had it the whole time. And they're all, fuck, okay, you guys can leave. So they let us go.
Just like that.
Just like that.
After three days.
Did they feed you tacos in there? What did they do?
They didn't give us any food.
No way.
None.
No fucking way. What year was this?
This was probably 82, 81.
Fuck.
A lot of my great stories from punk rock happened around there.
Did you play punk rock?
No, I was in, I was always like the road crew for all these bands because there's a guy named Eddie Joseph from Eddie and the Subtitles. It was an old punk band. They did, you know, American Society was their song, whatever. And he started doing too much heroin and got hooked and wanted to sell all of his equipment because he's the one that had the older dude with all the equipment. He had a Marshall Stag, an Ampeg, you know, a V9 cabinet with an SVT head. And he had he had a van to take it in. He had a PA system, a PVPA with microphones. So when all the kids at my school wanted to play the big shows, they wanted to have the good equipment. And like the Adolescents, Social Distortion, Agent Orange. And
they all came from right over here.
Right here, my high school. I went to high school with them all. And so when they were doing the band stuff, I would be the roadie with my friend who bought all the equipment, and we would, you know,
set it up,
tear it down, make sure no one would steal shit, get head for getting chicks backstage and all that kind of stuff. It was fucking awesome. It was a golden years of punk rock. And
oh my God.
I was doing shows 5 nights a week and going to school. I'd get to school at third period from Hollywood because I couldn't find a ride home and I'd have to hitchhike home from Hollywood to get to school.
Oh my gosh.
I went
you
to
couldn't fit in the van? Was a van filled with sound equipment?
I was probably getting a blowjob. I don't know. I missed the bus.
Oh, fuck.
Missed the bus and get, you know, one time I almost became the manager of DOA from Canada, Joey Shithead's band, because their manager said, I'm going to stop being their manager. I'm going to go be the manager for Circle Jerks. You want to be their manager? And I said, okay. So I get in the van, where are we going? They go, we're going to Canada. I'm like, oh, fuck, I don't want to go to Canada. So I fucking dove into another car full of punkers, and I don't know where I ended up somewhere, but it was always an adventure. It's like just freeballing all day, every day.
That's fucking
wild. It was a lifestyle. It was cool.
What were the venues like back then?
Out here? There's a lot. We go to like the Olympic Auditorium or the Vex or Cuckoo's Nest. My sister had a house around the corner from Cuckoo's Nest, so I was there all the time. And
Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, that was in Costa Mesa. That was a great venue.
No shit.
It's a public storage place now. They tore it all down, but
you know, one venue I played that was probably around back then was the Doll Hut.
I went to the Doll Hut. That happened a little bit later in life. I'd already been doing motorcycle stuff for a few years before I found the Doll Hut. That's really? Where I met Jesse.
Really?
He was like the bouncer there. And a friend of mine said, hey, you want to go for a ride with my friend? He's the bouncer at Doll Hut. And I'm all, sure. We went riding around with the owner of the Doll Hut. And I was doing bike surfing and, you know, just being a fucking full menace on the bike all over the place. And when we get to Cook's Corner, and the guy, John Mello, who owned the Doll Hut, said, you ride like a fucking asshole, and if you crash, I'm leaving you there, but if you make me crash, I'll kill you if I can't fuck it, if I can get up. And Jesse said, don't listen to him. I'll fuck him up for you. Why would I need you to fucking stick up for me? I'll fuck that guy up. And we became friends, and he's like, the next week, he told my friend Roger, he's like, hey, tell that Simon kid, I want to go ride with him again. Let's go fucking go do some more stuff. And we just became friends.
What'd you start on?
Bikes. Bikes?
Yeah. Did you ride dirt out here? I mean, this is like the dirt bike capital as well as the punk rock.
When I graduated from high school, my parents got me a Gibson SG guitar for my graduation present. I tried playing it for a month or so, and I traded it to a dude for a CB350 or whatever, some shitty Jap bike. And no helmet law out here, no fucking license. Just, I didn't even know how to change the oil. I just drove that thing till it fucking died. And then I got my friend sold me a Triumph, a Bonneville that was in a basket case. And there's a guy who lived on the next street was Keith Moore, and he had a Triumph shop, so he said, I'll show you how to put that thing together. You know, I'm not going to do it for you. You're going to do it yourself.
Perfect.
So then I had
Did
that
Did you have much mechanical knowledge before then? I mean,
no.
You were working on cars or nothing out here?
No, I was a fucking punk kid just going to fucking party.
Fucking thumb out, dude.
Yeah, whatever, man. What does it take to have a good time? I'm in.
Yeah.
So But then I started learning how to do all that. I mean, when I was a kid and I had a BMX bike and we were doing the bicycles and stuff, I'd like make fenders and stupid little gas tanks and try to, you know, make my bike look like a motorcycle.
Oh, yeah. So you already in it. You already wanted
it. I had the bug.
Yeah.
So then after the Triumph, I got a Sportster.
Did you build the Triumph into a chopper, or was it just like...
No,
just
I built it stock. Yeah, I went to the stock. Drove it around a lot.
Is that what Keith did mainly with stock stuff, or did he do custom?
He just did anything for Triumph.
Really?
Triumph from BSA shop.
Okay.
But...
I mean, that couldn't have been... There couldn't have been a lot of those around here, was there?
No. He was like the one dude that... In Southern California, he was like the old man that everybody wanted to go to for their Triumphs and stuff. But... And after that, I got a Harley, and I tried to make... I got split tanks for it, like, to make it look like a
for
big
a Sportster.
Twin. Yeah, I wanted a big ape hangers and split. I wanted, you know, you're a kid, you don't know this shit. I didn't know anyone. I wasn't going to shows or nothing. I just wanted to fucking ride. I'd put on a bright headlight and ride around at night thinking I was the Knight Rider, you know? Fucking screaming and yelling, fuck yeah! When I'm riding around the neighborhoods, just, fuck, this is awesome!
Yeah.
But, Like I said, I started doing writing. I met Jesse, and he was working on stuff and doing a few things. And so we just started building stuff together and making things and got noticed. And there's a lot of history with that we did a lot of things starting out from not having a shop and being, you know, a punker dude and a bouncer dude that ride motorcycles to having, you know, kind of game-changing shop.
Yeah, dude. I had no idea that you were, I mean, I heard that you were involved with them. Carrie had mentioned it at one point, but I didn't know that it was that early on.
No, we started it. We were hunting for, one of the things we first started doing after we were making our own parts and doing things, and he would set up a paint booth in his shop out of PVC. And
so what, did you guys just like build each other a bike or like build?
Just building stuff for our own bikes, making our bikes cool. And then Someone said, hey, can you do that for me? I want one. Because there wasn't as many people making stuff. It's like you get your part out of a catalog, and they go, well, that isn't exactly what I wanted.
And what year was this?
This was probably 86, 87.
Okay.
And so...
So the chopper stuff had kind of like faded away at that point, too, like the custom stuff?
Yeah,
I mean, I guess in Texas...
Kind of, yeah, it was kind of... It wasn't... Like the... It was a different kind of chopper that developed from what we started from when we didn't do anything. Like, people were just modifying old bikes, you know, like trying to make their shovel head look cool. So I had a shovel head, and I put every different front end, every different handlebar, every different tail fender, you know, different tanks, Sportster tank, split tanks, trying to make it, figure out how things put together and work. And you know, we just... did a lot of that with each other's bikes, and people noticed it. And
I mean, did you go to shows or swap meets or
we would
I mean,
do some of the shows
or just bars?
Bars and shows, and it's around here. Like there was like one guy, Al Martinez, who would have a show like two times a year, but then it was so fun that he would have it three times a year, then he'd do like every month, and it's like started thinning out. Like nobody wanted to do stuff that often out here. There's like, and but we would, when I first met him, like I said, when we were starting out, all we wanted to do was take a ride to other people's shops all over this, you know, Southern California, Micah McCloskey's shop up in Canoga Park, or we go to the, you know, the Dago Custom Shop or Dago Choppers in San Diego. Like every weekend we would go, let's go check out this shop and check out that shop. And every time we went to these shops, you know, it was like, fuck, and these dudes are just old fucking speed freaks and just hermits and shit. They don't even fucking know what they're doing. They're like, there's a market they're not even capturing. So we started planning on what kind of shop we wanted to have. We want to have a shop where it's a destination where people want to come and hang out and spend money and fucking. That's how we got the idea of doing our shop, to make it more, you know, more eye candy for when people come in instead of some place that just had shit everywhere. You know.
Yeah, I mean, most motorcycle shops that are working, they're, you know, there's shit everywhere. It's not like.
Clean.
There's no presentation to it.
Yeah, we wanted to do that. We wanted to bring people to have a place to stay, like, you know, have a refrigerator full
of beers.
Was
there another shop that was doing something similar, or like anything that you guys are drawing inspiration from, or just
nope.
like?
We just draw inspiration from what we didn't see.
Okay.
We said, there's something missing from all these shops. There's something that's not going on anywhere. No one's got a showroom where, I mean, a Harley dealer, but
there's no destination place.
No, not at all. And that's when, like, the TV shows were doing on the inside on, like, Discovery Channel, where they would go with the police station and follow a cop around all the time, or they'd go on the aircraft carrier and show what life was like on an aircraft carrier. And they kept wanting to do a lifestyle show about motorcycles because they wanted, and everyone they went to, like Ron Sims and Performance Machine and all the guys, everywhere, Dave Perowitz, all these people that they would try to ask, you know, well, who's someone that would be cool to, and everyone said Jesse's, West Coast Choppers, they're cool, they do cool stuff. And
so what was the first iteration of the shop like? Where was it at? What was it?
Well, it was kind of in the garage, but the first shop, we found a shop which was...
So you guys already, like, used the garage that you had to, like...
build stuff.
Yeah, and well, to start that style, that fucking destination.
No, the shop in the garage was more to make stuff and would get us noticed.
Okay.
And then when we had our first shop, was Performance Machine's old shop in Paramount, we started there, and we, you know... took a lot of time to, you know, tear it all down inside and fix it all up so it looks presentable for when people come in so that they're going to spend the money.
Yeah.
You know, you have come with trash and parts all over the place. People don't, you know, I'm not going to leave my...
That's funny. I was just telling somebody the other day, like, how there's an opportunity now, like, on the west side of Fort Worth where I'm at to put up a nice shop, like, you know, and do service for people. Like, nobody's going to buy a fucking $50,000 bagger and take it to any of the shops and leave it there.
No.
But if you made a nice place that people could come get, like, there's no place except for the dealership that does anything like that, where it's like a presentable, safe place where you would leave your bike to get worked on.
Well, we our presentation was, we have pride in what we're doing and we like what we're doing, and it's, you know, shows, so people were trusting of us to get their stuff done with us.
Yeah.
And they'd seen what we'd done before, so they go, well, I'll take a chance. So at first, we were just taking, like, chopper guy frames and you know, making a bike out of stuff like that. But it all started when, like, a lot of it started when Jesse went to work for Boyd, because we were doing stuff in the shop, and they said, well, we're going to start doing wheels and motorcycle engine parts. We want to have a division of Boyd's that's motorcycle parts. We called it Metal Tattoos, you know? And, so Jesse said, okay, I'll go to work for you as the front man, getting all of your products into the catalogs and selling it stuff. And we go to the dealer shows and stuff. And he said, I want Simo to come here and do the back end, schedule everything, get the parts going, you know, get the materials, handle the crew, and do the back end.
The logistics, yeah.
Yeah, I'll do everything, manage the back end, and he'll do the front end where he'll sell the stuff and be the face, and I'll be the bones behind it, you know. Uh-huh. So that's where it all started for me and him.
And that was working. Boyd's?
Boyd Coddington, Boyd Wheels.
Okay.
He was pretty huge. He won like 5 or 6 or 7 America's Most Beautiful Roadsters at the Grand National Roadster Show.
And shit.
He's really famous history of hot rodding.
So he was a great person to, like, get started with. Somebody that already had
He was very, very...
in his own right, but didn't have any motorcycle stuff.
Yeah, so he was the car guy. Yeah. He was like the champion of all car guys. And he goes, I want this kid to come in and run my motorcycle shot part of it. And that was good for a while, and then Jesse branched out on his own. He, like, moonlight the West Coast Choppers. So when he got to talk to all the catalog people saying, you know, Boyd wants to get into this market, and they'd say, oh, that's cool, and go, oh, and by the way, I want to do this sheet metal for bikes on my company too, my little moonlight job, and they go, oh, that's cool. So
how did Boyd feel about that?
Boyd fired him at one point because it was not working out the way he wanted it or something. So, but that was the best thing that could have happened to Jesse anyways, because it, you know,
lit the fire under him to get thing going.
Yeah, it made him focus on what he needed to do for himself instead of working for someone else. So it worked out. And I stayed back with Boyd because he wasn't in a position to pay me to bring me with him with his production. He wasn't that well known yet.
Yeah.
So I stayed on with Boyd's for a while, and then when Jesse's stuff took off and started getting more to a point where he could hire me to run his stuff so he could focus on, you know, still going forward with his persona, and he said, I need you to handle my back end stuff. So I went to work for him. And between Boyd and him, I think I went back and forth between the two companies about 8 times because Jesse would get mad at me because we're friends and fire me. And Boyd would be like, you got fired again? Come here. I want you to fucking work for me. And so I'd go work for Boyd. And then his sons would be starting being a jerk to me. So I'd fuck you to them. And Jesse, oh, you don't work for Boyd? Come work for me again. Yeah. Oh, so I went back and forth for almost a decade between the two companies. And the best of times and the worst of times at times, you know, it's like,
yeah.
there was a lot of fun stuff that happened and there were some challenges too.
Well, the first time I heard about Jesse before, or maybe it was around the time of the TV shows, but I didn't watch the shit when it was coming out.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember like some people I knew would talk about the parties. Cause I got into, you know, the bikes later on, but they were talking about like traveling from Texas to go to a West Coast chopper bike nighter. There was like a monthly party.
It was, they had a, no, when the No Love Ride would come here to California, like there was like a big, big deal that all the celebrities would go to this ride to, and so we would have the day before, we'd have the No Love Party, okay, the day before the Love Ride. And we'd have punk bands and skateboard ramps and motocross fucking freestyle jumpers. It was like a whole big to-do, and everyone would come out to see our party every year.
Was that before the TV show?
It was after, because the TV show happened. We had like 2 No Love parties before the TV show, I think. And then when the TV show happened, it blew up, I think.
The possibilities were endless at that point, huh?
I think when they decided to air it, it was on a week when there was a blizzard on the East Coast, and then they showed it like 5 times in 1 week when no one could leave their house. So like, it's like, boom.
It was,
the phones just fucking broke. The internet broke. We had a closet where we sold shirts, and there was a line out the door like 2 blocks long of people coming to our shop trying to buy shirts. And they're like sitting at the gate looking at like, I fucking thought I was a fucking zoo animal or something being watched at. But like, you know, like, I'm on display.
So you were working at them when the show launched.
Yeah, it was crazy. I had fucking answering the phones, and people are, you know, is Jesse there? I'm like, your first question was free. I'm going to switch you to the 876 number. You get charged by the minute for these fucking dumbass questions.
I can only imagine. I had a friend, he did one of those shows with Richard Rollins where he like comes in and remodels your shop or whatever.
Okay.
You know, this is like, I don't know, 10 years ago. And he said it was fucked after that. He had to change the name of a shop just because people would come in and want to buy t-shirts. He's like, I don't fucking sell t-shirts.
I don't think it's that way anymore. I think at first when it was a new phenomenon of these reality shows and the TV, like, you know.
Well, this was pretty recent, you know, considering when that happened with Jesse. Like, this was.
I mean, it was out of control.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, if it was like that for him 5-10 years ago, I can't imagine back then, like, the volume.
Oh, it went from trying to figure out how to pay the payroll to fucking, you know, oh, Walmart wants to do another shirt. You have to pay us $1 million just for the rights to do it. And then you give us a percentage of everything that you sell. You know, fucking that dude made so much money from all that stuff. And, you know, Huffy wants to make a bicycle that looks like a chopper. If that's fine, $1 million, you can, if you know, whatever. Just kept.
Did he bring in somebody that, like, knew those ropes, or did he know how to? Like,
he had help, but
licensing. I mean,
he had a legal team. He had a publicist, a legal team. We had a designer. This guy that was an art guy for Mazda came in and did a lot of design for us. Mike Desmond, he's a pretty talented guy. And everyone, he surrounded himself, because once we got known, everybody who was anybody wanted to come in the shop and make a name for themselves and help. And so there's a lot of talent that came through the shop. But you could figure out the people that were just, you know, want to get on the leg just to get their own thing way going up. Yeah, you could tell those people pretty quickly. And then there's other people that really wanted to, you know, make the fucking shop something of a fixture for a long time. So, yeah. And I had to, you know, one of my jobs was to try to, you know, figure out who's who.
Yeah. who was coming to actually be a part of the team and who was just doing it for their own.
And sometimes future. I would tell Jesse and he'd be all fucking thanks. And sometimes y'all sounds like you're jealous of that guy. You know, it's, it depends. So it was all over the map. It was a good time. It was fun.
I mean, that was a heyday, you know? I mean,
it was trippy.
It's what's impressive about that story, or from what I saw or what I see looking back, is that he was able to do that without like completely being taken advantage of. We're like, or at least it seems that way, you know, like, but
that
like
dude musicians, can, that like, dude can kick
a lot of people get a rise because of TV or a production company, but they don't ever really get the benefits of it. Like, it seemed like he had somebody in his court from early on.
No, he was brutal. He's fucking, he can kick almost anyone I know's ass. He's a fucking fighter. He spars. He works out, and he's got that fucking, that mindset where it's like, you know, get the fuck out of my way unless you're going to go with me. Stand by me or behind me, but not in front of me.
Yeah.
You're fucking going down if
so
you
said that attitude from the get-go.
Oh, huh? Yeah. Like, his attitude was he could find someone with something and go, oh, that thing's a fucking piece of shit. I'll give you $5 for it. And someone, okay, and he'll take it and he'll turn to the next guy. This is the fucking coolest shit you've ever seen. I want $500 for it. Yeah. And people, oh, okay. A full horse trader, you know, like.
Buy low, sell high.
Yeah. He's just had a natural, you know, charisma for doing that kind
one
of stuff.
One thing I'll never forget, I heard it on, you know, one of those shows, was he was talking about like going to work with the rush hour in the morning. And then one day he was like, he had to go to work early for something. And he just saw all these really nice cars out on the highway. And the traffic was moving nice at 5 o'clock. And he's like, oh, the fucking smart people making the money get fucking started early.
Yeah. You
know, before the rush hour, where all the shitty vehicles are on the road.
Yeah.
I've never forgot that comment. But yeah, so how did you fucking work through all that, you know?
I just kept busy doing everything I was, you know, like I handled so many hats when I was at those shops. I mean, I would be, you know, the production manager, security, customer service, you know, purchasing. I'd have to get all the material, scheduling, make sure I had enough material to keep, you know, 60 people not standing around waiting.
Is that how many people? Is it 60 people building bikes?
Building exhaust, fenders, bikes, all the things, frames, everything to front end, apparel. We had at one point, I think we had like 60 employees, and it had to, you know, kind of keep everything together. And
so
it was,
wild.
And it was, to me, I've equated it to, and with, like I said, with the Dig Me personalities coming in because of the show, everybody. It was like there was like always a little bit of cutthroat shit going on here and there because people wanted me out of their way so they could advance, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's like trying to sprint to keep things together at full speed while looking over your shoulder for the fucking person who's gonna fucking throw the wrench out in your legs to try to trip you up, you know.
Yeah.
It's like there's that one guy or the two guys that had it out for you that, you know, you had to keep your eye on them while you're trying to fucking keep your eye on everything else. It was a challenge. It was fun, though, you know. It was exhausting. That's why the last time I got fired, I said, I just want to drive a water truck with a loud stereo. I did not want to fucking manage anything except for getting dirt wet.
Was that when it was still out here, I assume?
It was in...
Hey, Wilbur, come here. Come on now. We know you want to be on the podcast too, but...
Hey. So, it was before the beginning of the end. It's like, because, you know, then all these companies were upstarting and all the other chopper companies and other people were figuring out the formula and trying to do stuff. And so his market share was shrinking a little bit and he thought it was because... You know, I wasn't bringing new things to the table. I'm all, this is your company. You're the designer. You come up with new stuff. Why are you having me come up with ideas of things for when I'm just trying to fucking keep the things that we're doing going?
Yeah.
Bring me something new. Don't tell me to get something new. You know, that's not my specialty here. And so he let me go. And then soon after that, he had a lot of problems with his wife in the media where he was at the Academy Awards with Sandra Bullock and stuff happened. I mean, life went south for him and he just said, fuck it, I'm done here. This California, everyone's in your business. And the AQMD was trying to sue him because he didn't conform to CARB specifications on the manufacturing of the bikes. And they sued him for a lot of money and tried to take him to court. And then all the different things, you know, people coming at him for all, you know, when you're in the limelight, everybody wants a piece of you. And he said, I'm done with California. I'm out of here. It was one of the first of the, you know, there's a lot of people leaving California these days, but he was early on about getting the fuck out of here.
Going to fucking Texas. They fucking have slowly followed him too.
Well, it's like cancer, California. It's going to eat up the whole world someday.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine at that level, like just managing relationships, you know, when, you know, you don't even know what angle people are coming at from that point, whether it's the fucking media or somebody who just wants to ride coattails or, you know, or friends that you've had for a long time, yeah. You know? I mean.
Yeah, and you just got to watch out because people want to steal and they think that, you know, well, why should Jesse make millions and millions of dollars when I'm only making, you know, $30,000 a year? I need to fucking supplement my income and here's my chance to do some, you know, out backdoor stuff here and trying to keep that from happening. And just my head was on a swivel, but I couldn't watch everything.
Yeah.
It was a little overwhelming at times.
So what year did you take off?
I've been, 2007 was my last year there.
Okay.
So like I said, from the 90s.
So you got out right before the fucking shit really hit the fan for the whole world, really.
Kind of, yeah.
I mean, I guess it, what, 2006, 2007, they were still selling bikes in my area for like, you know, $60,000, you know, like the Iron Horse Chopper.
Yeah. You know, that's what we're selling our bikes for, 60 to 120.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, but soon and after people were that, buying they them. All fucking...
Everything. Well, yeah, because then the stock market crashed and no one had fucking that extra money anymore. Uh-huh. But I was amazed that people are fucking dumbasses spending $60,000 on a bike as a lawyer and wants to fucking, you know, get a fucking tribal tattoo, get a fucking chopper and fucking, yeah, I'm bad.
Oh, dude, they were.
Yeah.
They fucking were. I mean, in Texas, it was the oil-filled guys. Oh, yeah. You know?
Roughnecks and stuff,
so
making
much
money.
Fucking money on those things.
We were selling them. It was definitely a thing.
I mean, I think his have held value better than any other of those bikes that came out around that time.
Well, that's because the production shit was fucking crap, though. It was all fucking mass-produced shit that was. Yeah. I mean, our
Did
bikes.
Did you guys ever bring in frames, or you guys always make frames in house?
Orange County Choppers had a TV show called American Chopper, whatever it was, and we said that they were fucking cake decorators and we were bakers because we would make everything. I'd order tubing, sheet metal, you know, billets of aluminum, billets of steel, and we would make everything in-house. Jesse's whole mantra was, I don't want to create an invoice by buying something from someone else. We're going to make everything we do, it's made here.
Wow.
So it was all done. I mean, we'd buy a transmission from Bert, or he would give us cases of, like, pallets of cases to polish and trade for transmissions for the bikes for
So you guys would polish for Baker in exchange for transmissions.
Exactly. And then S&S, you know, we would use the S&S motors. But other than that, everything... You know, there's a few components we had to buy. We didn't want to make our own brake calipers. Brake calipers, you know. What's that? Brembo made a good package, so we would just use those because they work perfectly. Yeah. You don't want to try to invent stuff that's already done, but all the aesthetics we would do ourselves.
What about wheels? Did you guys make
wheels? We automate our own wheels.
Really?
Yep. We'd have like, I think we had 7 CNC machines and 2 lathes.
Wow.
We had a not a water jet, but a laser cutter for cutting sheet metal and stuff, up to like 3/8 thick.
Did you guys ever stamp any of the sheet metal, or was it all hand hammered?
It's all hand hammered.
So fucking wild, dude. I mean, I don't know of any other, you know, bike manufacturer that put that much effort into building their bikes. You know, that didn't buy frames.
No.
Or get tanks. Or
at one point, Custom Chrome came to us with a pallet of fenders and tanks and said, hey, we made these in China. You know, you're going to start having, we're going to start selling these under your name, or we're going to sell them under our own name. You choose. You know, they kind of strong-armed us into, so a lot of stuff that came out of those big bike catalogs that you see on a lot of bikes, the villain tank and stuff, that was made in China. But if it came on a bike that we made in-house, it was all done by hand.
Wow. Huh. Yeah. That's a lot. That's a fucking lot. Do you know what the numbers are? How many bikes?
I think when we were in California, I think we made like 280 bikes.
Wow.
Total. Okay. Something around there.
Yeah. So that's really not a ton.
No.
No shit.
But frames, we made a couple thousand frames.
Okay.
So people make their kit bikes and they say they have a West Coast Chopper CFL. It's like, you know, can spot the ones that someone made in their garage pretty quick, you know.
Yeah.
I can spot the ones that we made are a little more detailed finesse. There's certain parts that we wouldn't let out the door that would only go on our in-house builds, so you can kind of tell them apart. Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty.
That's wild. The celebrities you're buying, who did you have to deal with? What was the goofiest shit you guys did?
Well, I got called a fucking idiot by William Shatner. In my best Hulk Hogan voice, I said, "Nanu, nanu, brother," and I held out my hand in a V shape, and he's all, "You're a fucking idiot."
Oh my gosh. Now, were you guys, did you get to go to shows? Or, I mean, like, it kind of took off. Like, at that point, you guys didn't have to go, like.
Nah, we did shows to begin with, but it was mostly local stuff. Went to Sturgis a couple times, but then just, we were so busy. We had enough work. We didn't need to really advertise.
Yeah.
And promote our product or our brand.
The TV did all that, right?
Yeah, it was already.
How was it dealing with, like, when the TV was there filming? I mean.
They would always get a lot of footage, and they would come up to me and they would say, "Hey, that was great. You know, we want to have you sign this waiver so we can use the footage." I say, "Get the fuck away from me. I do not want to be on TV." Did not want that. I didn't. Because I would see, like, when we go to the races at the drag races, when the pro classes, the fuel cars were going down the strip, I would be in the area, like, going through people's coolers looking for beers and burritos and getting food and drinks, and there's no one there, and they're fucking, all the people are at watching the deal. And then after Jesse got famous, we couldn't do that anymore, because he'd have like 40 people deep every direction trying to get an autograph, and we weren't moving. I'm never coming to the races with you again, because this is dumb.
Damn.
I'd be standing off the side, they don't even know who the fuck I am, but he's like, you know, like the fucking center of this huge flower of people just coming at him. I'm all, I didn't sign up for that.
Yeah, that's fucking gnarly.
Did you see
that change? Did that, like,
yeah,
did it wear on his patience? I mean.
It did. It was changes.
Had to have.
Yeah. He had to have. He became a different person to a certain degree, and he's the same person to a certain degree. There's, you know, it's just like with all of us. As you grow, you learn and do things differently. You don't have the same shit that, you know, like the people I was hanging out with in high school are definitely not the people I'm hanging around with now. I mean, I still have a handful of them that I still talk to, but when I was in the punk scene, I fucking, like, you know, the king of the world. I knew everybody. I'd go everywhere. I'd fucking, you know, put my dick in all kinds of girls, and, you know, it was fun, but I don't even, like, I could stare them in the face right now and not even know that I was with them when I was a kid.
Did you get to ride much back then? Like, when you guys were working that much? I mean, did you still, like...
I would ride to work and back. I didn't go out on an adventure like you do. Like, when you get to go far and
check places out.
No, yeah. I just do city riding around here. I didn't really start doing too many, like, adventure riding until I met Carrie Brobeck, and we started doing a lot of adventure riding together.
Nice.
So he was my partner in crime when we started doing the riding stuff.
Yeah.
I met him after I was so prolific at getting chicks that I got cancer from eating pussy. That's what they told me. I mean, I had stage 4 cancer on the base of my tongue.
Oh my God.
And I took 6 months out of my life of chemo and radiation, and I'm surprised I didn't die. But I met Dana.
Really? Especially getting it in the face.
Chemo
and radiation?
Right on my neck, all over the place. It was hard, but I met Dana, who I'm, you know, we got married after I finished all my stuff, but I met her like 2 months before I got diagnosed, and she didn't bail. She stuck with me and helped me with everything. And I kept calling her my Huckleberry because she wouldn't leave, and she'd just be there for me for everything. I'm like, this fucking chick's great. And I started calling her the Cotillion because most of the chicks I know would say, fuck you, you're a dick. And uh-huh. But she'd always say, yes, please, and thank you. And I'm like, you're so nice, you know? It's like, so I scored with her. We got married, and she took care of me. It was, you know, it's just amazing that someone would stick with you when they just met you, and they go, you're faced with all that. I mean, especially being a punker and a biker. I mean,
it's tough to stick with. You know, when you've known him for a long time.
Yeah.
And that's a tough situation, you know?
Yeah. It was rough, but I made it. I've been around for 11, 12 years since then and still having fun. But I met him because someone said, hey, you need to talk to Simo. He's done this, he's done that. And so I met him and just hit it off really good. He's a good guy. I like him.
Yeah. Is this when he was with Easy Rider, or he's just...
He was just starting to like dabble with Easy Riders, but you know, he was more of the Douche LaRouche guy, like ending his Douche LaRoucheness okay, and starting yeah. his like yeah. trying to branch off into some
yeah.
something more.
Yeah.
And that's when I met him and said, "Yeah, let's do some stuff, go for some rides." And you know, it was fun. We went to Mexico a couple of times, went to Sturgis, and just a lot of cool riding with him.
Yeah. What were you on then?
I was mostly on my FXR.
Yeah, the one right in here?
Yeah.
So you've had that for a minute.
Yeah.
Did you buy that? Well, that wouldn't have been brand new.
No, I bought it from a guy who was the first owner. It was a 93, and I think I got it. And when would, what's like...
Before FXRs were hot? I guess they've always been pretty popular out here, huh?
We were 24. I probably brought it in 2015.
Okay.
Before all the pandemic and all the weird stuff, it was like after my treatments.
Yeah.
I said, you know, that's when I might, because before I got cancer, it's like life turned into a different thing afterwards, after I finished all my treatments and survived it. So, you know, life's precious. You got to fucking get your stuff done before you can't do it.
Yeah.
Either because you're too old or you're dead, you know, live life and have fun and ride motorcycles and, you know, just be cool to people and have fun.
Yeah, that's the fucking way to do it. Be cool to people, have fun. Yep. What do I say? Family first, fun second, safety third.
They preach safety at work. They can have that. It's my off hours. When I'm not at work, I'm not at safety.
Yeah.
When I'm at work, I have to follow a lot of rules. So, you know, I drive hazmat. I drive a compressed gas trucks and
which
stuff.
Which is fucking, there is, that is just dangerous, especially out here. At any point, you can get fucking rear-ended. I play music with a guy who did that same shit. He would deliver belt, mainly just delivered to welding shops.
Yeah.
Or welding supply houses.
Yeah.
Dude, he would talk about these fucking shows or videos they would make him watch at his safety meetings. Yeah. Those bottles just blowing up, going through the fucking
truck. Well, I'm more scared of the shit falling on me, fucking breaking my foot or my leg or my arm or something, you know, or... Just, or they're so strict on safety is getting busted for a safety violation because they got cameras watching me while I'm driving. Oh, I can't use my phone. I can't eat food. I can't drink while I'm driving. Then the same camera faces forward. So if I like roll through a stop sign or a train crossing, I get hit up.
GPS on you.
Oh, yeah.
They can tell how fast you're hitting your gas pedal.
They have a safety department. They'll follow me around once a year to do like a road check to see what I'm doing out on the road.
Oh, my God.
I don't know who's going to be, when it's going to be. And fuck all that. I can't wait to stop working and just totally party a lot more.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I'm being party, I don't mean like getting drunk. I just mean like riding and enjoying life and uh-huh. going to shows and adventure traveling.
Yeah, that's what I like to do.
Because I've got a shorter and shorter window to get that done, and I want to make sure I get it done.
Oh, dude, I started thinking about it, you know, recently, like, all right, I turned 40 this year. I got 10 more summers before I'm 50. You know, not that I'm going to stop at 50, but, like, I just started thinking about that in those terms, like.
I'm 61.
Yeah.
Fuck. I didn't know that I was going to make it past 21.
I
was reckless.
Oh, I do believe that.
I was reckless. That. It was a really magical time here in Orange County in the 80s, you know, when I was a teenager. It's like.
And you survived that.
I thrived in it, man. It was the best.
Well, what do you think about this new wave that's happened with the, you know, it's different than what, you know, happened with West Coast Choppers in Orange County and all those chopper building TV shows. But there's been a resurgence, you know, in the last 10 years. Really inspired by that, you know, the kids that fucking saw that shit on TV have gone out and started doing their own thing their own way that's a little different than back then.
I think it's any form of motorcycle, you know, awareness and more participation and people rejoicing in that. I don't give a fuck what brand you ride. I don't, you know, and I love Harleys myself. That's yeah. my preference. But two wheels, dude, chick, Anybody who wants to ride, that's just better for everyone in the world. Because when you're on a bike and you're riding, something happens to you and you're at peace with everything and you understand things better and you're a better person because of it, you know?
Absolutely.
It's just 100%. I don't give a fuck what they're doing as long as it's on two wheels. And it's going to turn out good, I think.
Well, you know, it's amazing that California is this cancerous, as you say, because there are so many motorcyclists out here, you know? I mean, they sell more fucking dirt bikes in this area than the rest of the country combined.
I don't know why. There's no place to ride them out here. You have to go somewhere different to get on, to take your dirt bike to go riding.
Well, there's places to ride. There's got to be.
There's a few. There's a few off-road vehicle areas, but they're like, you know, two hours away from here.
There's tracks. There's lots of tracks.
Yeah. What I think is weird is that, you know, like, everyone's trying to do the bikes that all left before, like in the 80s and 70s and 80s, all of the cool bikes that are cool now went to Japan. So Japan has all of our history.
Yeah, they got a lot of it.
They got a lot of it. And so, you know, I want to see how people are going to bring it back. You know, go there and bring the stuff back. I don't know how easy it's going to be, but they've got a lot of stuff that should be back
from
here.
From what I understand, they really appreciate it over
there. Do, but I like it to be here. I'm going to go to Japan, I think, this year to Moon Eyes.
Are you?
I think we're talking in talks about going there and taking the brand there and see if we can, you know, augment our trip with some sales.
Mm-hmm. I think they'd appreciate it over there.
I think so.
Yeah, how did the Huckleberry brand, how did that come about? What was the...
Well, like I said, when I was in cancer treatment, I kept calling her my Huckleberry. And then when I started getting better, I figured you've always had this talent with graphic arts and art, and you should do something. And she worked at the company she works now, which is an apparel trim company who makes patches and hang tags and labels and stuff. Well, you know, you could make stuff either for people we know that are buying patches anyways and do it, or some kind of thing that's going to involve where you work now, moonlighting a little bit. So
yeah,
she said, I don't really want to promote the things we do at work, 'cause we do a lot of stuff overseas, but I do like the ideas. And then when we got married, we had a bandana made by an artist that we gave to our friends, our guests, appreciation.
Like a wedding gift.
Yeah, so to the people that came out, we got married in Texas, and everyone we invited on our A-list was like 70 people. They 100% participation. Everyone said, yeah, and flew out to Texas to go to our wedding. Wow. It wasn't like some of them did, like everybody we invited, so we didn't even get to go to the B-list. So, but we gave those bandanas out, and my one friend said it was the best cum rag he ever got. And he's like, this is fucking awesome. Well, we should do one with my face and Dana's face and give that to you for a cum rag. Dana said, no, no, no. But that's when it clicked to her. Go, well, maybe we can start doing our own things, because no one else was doing like bandanas as a specialty. And so we started just doing stuff with artists. And basically we like to have artists collab with us so we can develop a relationship with the artist and meet people and go places and bring their stuff to other people and give them, you know, some more, you know, audiences and stuff, and it's just been fun. Different art forms, like we made those little copper hats, you know, because we used old vintage ones that we find at old like antique stores and stuff, and we use them to hold down the bandanas, like a stack of bandanas, so they don't blow away. And people always ask, oh, those are cool. How much are those? And Dave's like, no, I had to hunt for that. I'm not selling that. Those are not very easy to come by. So I said, let's make some.
The Cowboys are in right now, too. Well, hats, bandanas.
All that stuff. We jumped into a wave that was fucking peaking right now. So,
dude.
But it's fun. I mean, I don't see us doing this for, like, you know, 10 or 15 more years, but maybe 5 more years doing this stuff and then moving on to, like, something that's less taxing. And, you know, I got, when I'm 65, 66 years old, I kind of want to just not work and go traveling.
Yeah.
You know, just have fun.
Yeah.
See the whole country all day, every day, you know. Go places, do stuff. So that's the goal. Give it all up for travel.
I love it. I love it.
Just be a vagabond.
I mean, that is the goal, man, is to see it all.
Yeah.
You know?
While you can, you know, while you can enjoy it, while you can do something about it.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Well, man, I appreciate you having us. I look forward to hanging out with you over the next few days.
It's going to be awesome.
We're going to have fun. What, you guys got some stuff coming up.
Yeah,
we're gonna be board free this weekend.
Next weekend.
And then next weekend is,
we're gonna be at the Jackalope Jamboree.
See, that's gonna be so good.
That's in Pendleton, Oregon.
You've done that one before,
no,
right?
No, I've never done it before. But a girl that, like, when we go to these shows, other vendors become carnies. You're like, you make relationships with the other vendors around. And this girl that we met at a couple shows, she's got a vintage shop. She's the curator of the vendors at this Jackalope Jamboree. She said, you guys have to come up here.
Yeah.
So we're doing it mostly to support her and to have fun and go up there and do that. And then we come back for a couple of days, and then we go to Whitefish, Montana for Under the Big Sky.
Yeah.
And that one's cool because they have a curated group of tattoo artists that do tattooing up there. And we got several of them to do a bandana design for that show. So we're going to promote them, and they're going to promote us. So
that's,
it's going to be relevant to each other. And they're all local artists that came from the area, and that show's one of our finest ones. We like it, and basically they don't charge us for a space, but they just would like for us to give a percentage of our sales to them so they can put it to charity.
That's amazing.
Local food banks and there's like a thing that saves farmland that we that's their charity of choice. So we're happy to give them a bunch of dough time we go up there.
That's amazing.
And it's just beautiful up there. I can't wait to see Pendleton, but I know that the Montana show,
I mean, I've heard people talk about that festival, the Jackalope, that it's fucking good.
It's, yeah.
Whoever puts that on apparently is really good at curating, you know, the bands, the music.
Perfect.
And I imagine the vendors just the same.
Yep, I can't wait. We got a bunch of stuff. The next one after that, I think, was probably going to be Virginia City Roundup. That's a good show. Anyone who's listening should probably try to go to that show, because if you like motorcycles and cowboys and bulls, go up there, give them $20, sign your waiver, and fucking ride that goddamn bull.
And I'll fucking talk about it.
Yeah,
I'll be there this year again. Oh yeah,
I think it'll be a really good year this year. I think last year was kind of there's a little bit of something was going on with something. People up there, but this year everyone's on board on the same page, so I think it'll be even better this year.
Yeah, it's gonna be good.
There's a little discord, but now it's good.
Okay, Simo, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's continue. All right, that was a bitchin' show. You guys should have heard what that motherfucker had to say off air. And not that he was trying to not say it on air, we just didn't get there. Simo, Dana, thank you once again for having me and my wife up for, you know, to hang out. Stage your place, take us to the beach. It was amazing. Dude, make sure you go. There's a bunch of shit happening this summer. You know? Homecoming, Born Free, Homecoming, Sturgis, Virginia City, Party at the Pen, and then Born Free, Texas at the Yellow Rose Canyon in October. Home of the Prince Paints and Steel Art Show, as well as Danger Dan's Build Off Trade Off. And look forward to the shows coming out with those builders.
I've got another show I've done with Jeff Milburn, a recap on the bike riders, just to kind of like, you know, ask him a few more questions since I seen the film. I hope you guys have all gone out and watched the film yourself. Go check it out in theaters while you can, because, you know, it won't be there much longer. Thank you for all the support. This month's lucky Lowbrow Customs $100 winner, thanks for contributing $5 a month to Patreon, is, number four, Zachary Fortin. It does not even tell me where you live. Oh, I just fucked up. Zachary Fortin. Oh my gosh, I don't know how to work this thing. I just fucked up. Zachary Fortin, I got your name. I will look up your information again because somehow I just lost it all. Lowbrow Customs, thank you for supporting. You go check out Lowbrow for all your chopper needs. Get your shit dialed for this summer. This summer is already here. Get your shit dialed for life. Lowbrowcustoms.com. Knives made by Nick. Motorcycle Sherpa MC Shop Tees. Oh, dude. Thank you all. Talk to you soon. You got a lot of podcasts coming.